The Home Show with Sinead Ryan on News Talk.
Hello and welcome along to this episode of the Home Show podcast. My name is Sinead Ryan. This is News Talk's production about homes, housing, interiors and architecture. Coming up this episode, well, we're continuing our summer series on exclusive wedding venues, lovely old manor houses being converted. And this week we're heading to Ballymacarvey in County Meath. With hotter temperatures due to climate change, and we've certainly seen that in the past week, are we building our homes incorrectly for the future? The numbers in mortgage arrears is at a 16-year low. We find out why this may not be good news. And Denise O'Connor is in our design chair, distressing interiors planning. If you'd like to get in touch with us on the Home Show podcast, you can do so by email at thehomeshow@newstalk.com. And you'll find me over on Instagram at SineadRyan100. And we do love to hear from listeners to find out what you'd like us to feature on the Home Show in the future. And of course, all episodes and bits of shows are up on the Go Loud app on podcast. Now, our summer series on wedding venues in Ireland's lovely manor homes continues. We were in Clochjordan House in Tipperary last week, and we're moving up to Meath now to visit Ballymacarvey Village. Joining me now is Lisa Egan, the wedding team manager. Lisa, you're very welcome to the Home Show. Tell us a little bit about the history of Ballymacarvey.
Thank you very much, Sinead. So Ballymacarvey Village, like, we have a history going back to the 1100s. So the house itself was built for the Prince of Wales's daughter, so Princess Gwendolyn. So she married the son of Hugh de Lacy, and this was their home then when they got married. So there's a lot of history within the house itself and the grounds. So there is plenty of history in the area. Couples generally tend to, you know, like to come and visit the Boyne Valley. And when they're here on site, especially couples traveling over from America, they love to have that history intact and be part of that history as well.
Of course they do, in the Royal County, of course. Now, who owns the property now, and are they involved in the running of it?
Yeah, so it's Vincent Callan who is the owner of the venue itself. And he's very involved. So he bought the venue back in 2003, and we had our first wedding then in 2009. So a lot of time and work went into the venue when restoring it to its original settings, and a lot of hard work. But himself, his family, they're here on viewing evenings, you know, still having a walk around, being part there of that history, having conversations with couples. And it's lovely to see that they're all involved in the venue itself, even to this day.
Now, I've been lucky enough to be at a wedding in Ballymacarvey, so I can attest to the way it's very well run, and it's really, really beautiful. But there is a lot on offer of interest in the gardens and in the buildings themselves. You have an old flax mill. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so like that, you know, there's so much history. So originally we thought, you know, the venue dated back to the 1800s, and, you know, it was only going through the history. Sean, one of Vincent's brothers, you know, he, from the day he set up in Ballymacarvey, he just thought there was such a beautiful setting and environment here, and he loves the history itself. So he had to dig deep. But yeah, so it was originally the 1854, and then like that, with the venue, the documents itself were in the GPO, and with 1916, they were actually moved down to Portlaoise. So a lot of work went into it. The grounds itself, the buildings, they're all part of that history. So the Maxville is where the venues, where the wedding receptions take place in the evening time. So that's where our banquet hall and our mill loft are now. And the different buildings are named after pieces of history. So we have the likes of the maid's cottage, the governess, the farriers, to keep those bits of history throughout the building. Even though we're renovating and updating constantly, it's to have that pieces of history throughout the venue, even to this day and age.
Indeed. And it kind of allows that little kind of tradition to be maintained if people want to kind of do up a little itinerary for their guests, or, you know, that downtime between after the ceremony and before the dinner, and people like to wander around and have a look at what's going on. Now, what's on offer to couples planning their wedding, Lisa? Is it what kind of does a wedding coordinator do?
Yeah, so a wedding coordinator here on site, we'd look after kind of the venue side of things. So we'd be liaising with, you know, their cake suppliers, bands, photographers in the lead up to the day itself, but we wouldn't directly book them. It would be more so a wedding planner itself that would help the couple if they were wishing to have one, in liaising and helping select different suppliers. We ourselves, we'd be in contact with the couple throughout, you know, the lead up to the day, assisting them with their accommodation. Sometimes they'd come back with family members to view the venue or to see where they might lay out some items for the day. I generally tend to find the LED foam sticks are a popular option for later on in the night, or the bathroom baskets, the flip-flops, or even to have a look and see what room might suit particularly family members, you know, and to select which ones they'd prefer best. And then we'd be here on the day itself. So we'd be more so in the background. They'd have their operations manager who would be more visible to the guests on the day itself. But we'd be here making sure that everything we've discussed with the couple in the lead up to the day is all set out, ready for them, that they can just relax and enjoy the day itself and be there and present with their guests.
Now, you said that the banquet, the meal, takes place in the old flax mill. So this is a beautiful room. And do you do all the cooking on site, and how many can you cater for?
Yeah, so everything happens here on site. So we have our full kitchen team here. So it's a lot of work that continuously goes in, and we get great recommendations and confirmations of couples about the food continuously. But we can cater for up to 200 guests. I generally tend to find since COVID, couples are being more selective of their guests and trying to keep that intimacy in their wedding day itself so that they can enjoy that time with their family and friends and make the most out of the day.
Now, given that these event venues that we've been talking about in this series, these manor houses, and they're not hotels, so you can't just book in on a Friday night just for an overnight. These are exclusive hire places. Do you find then that that impacts on getting workers for the venue? I mean, can you offer them kind of full-time jobs, or are they just kind of pulled in when you have weddings on, or how does that work? Because I'm sure there must be a kind of a lot of people in the local community that value the work opportunities that are in Ballymacarvey.
Yeah, no, thankfully we have, you know, the majority of our team are full-time staff. We do have some part-time staff that come in more so that are on a weekend setting. But a lot of our team here are full-time, and thankfully, you know, we have the opportunity to offer that to, you know, staff that are live close by. And as you said, it is a great opportunity for people in the local area that we can avail to that. But no, thankfully, we have a great amount of couples who do choose Ballymacarvey and wish to have their wedding day here with us, and that we can offer that to our team here, that they have a full-time position.
Now, Camille, what's on trend for couples in 2026? Are they flying doves out of baskets? Are they doing all the hand clasping and fasting and ribbons and little notes and all kinds of things that I've been seeing at various weddings? What are guests asking you to do that might be a little bit offbeat?
I generally tend to find the most popular option at the moment or trend is the captains per table. So they'll select a member of each table to have a captain band or have a little note to, you know, maybe say, make sure everybody has a drink, or, you know, get a group photograph, that they want to have everybody involved. They want to have everybody present throughout the day.
Right. OK, so some of the guests are working for their supper. Now, where can people find out more about it, Lisa?
Yeah, so you can find out more on our website at ballymacarvey.ie. And then I generally tend to find nowadays Instagram is probably one of the most popular options for couples.
Well, then all the nice photography and all the beautiful scenery and everything. I'm not surprised that that's the case. Are you pretty much booked out for this year, the rest of this year and next?
We're busy this year and into next year, but there's always dates available depending on what couples are looking for.
All right, says the sales manager. All right, thank you very much, Lisa Egan, Wedding Team Manager at Ballymacarvey Village. And there you go. If you want someone with somewhere with a hit of history, then that would be the place to go. Now, coming up after the break, why you shouldn't be too precious about your renovations. See you in a few moments.
The Home Show on News Talk. The Home Show on News Talk.
Now, the very welcome but very intense hot weather spell due to a heat dome over Europe has meant our homes have become overheated. Now, this makes it more difficult to sleep, to get fresh air flowing. But here with some advice, but also to analyse what it means for our built infrastructure, is Michal Dishoon, Director of Dishoon Architecture. You're very welcome to the Home Show studio.
Thank you very much.
It has been enormously hot. And we are told that this is the new now, and climate change is meaning that this is going to be more frequent, and we're going to have to deal with higher temperatures in the future. It can be very difficult to cool down in homes. I suppose I don't live in an A-rated home, but I'm wondering whether it's even worse when you do this kind of airtight properties that we're building now to very strict regulations. Can they overheat, and does it get too hot?
Well, insulation works both ways. In your A-rated home, it'll stop heat coming in as much as it'll stop heat going out. The real key thing that'll determine whether your house heats up or overheats is down to windows. So if you've got windows, very large windows that face south, not so bad, but if they face west, you'll find that as the sun sets and goes a bit lower, you'll get an awful lot of sunlight in, or solar radiation, as it's also called. We call that a passive solar gain when we like it, when it's warming up your home and you're getting free energy. We call it just solar gain when we don't. And so that's a huge contributor to overheating.
Okay, so we're talking here, I mean, I don't want to go down the route of blaming Dermot Bannon, but he has certainly influenced the ginormous floor-to-ceiling kind of wraparound windows that we see on extensions, on houses nowadays, and certainly on modern homes. People love them. But this is when they are going to feel that shaft of heat and light coming in through their kitchen, usually, or wherever. Is it like in the future you don't see those type of floor-to-ceiling windows in Spanish homes, in Italian homes, in French homes, because they're so used to dealing with these very, very hot temperatures? Is that something we're going to have to give up in the future, or are we just like, oh no, just suck it up in the short time that we have heat?
No, what we're going to need to do is think about it. So where you put your window, what way it faces, what you're looking at. These are all things that do need to be considered. So when you're looking at, you know, environmental desire, how our buildings will interact with the climate, with their location, as it said, west-facing windows, big west-facing windows, you're definitely going to want to think about shading. Because, as we said, with a south-facing window, you know, people do enjoy getting the sunlight in through the winter. Mm. But the sun is quite high in the summer when it's, you know, problematic and giving us an awful lot of sunshine. And it's not too difficult to shade a south-facing window, you know, particularly a small canopy or stuff like that. Whereas... you know, you as the sun goes down, there's a lot of heat in the evening. So it's you look at Spain and Portugal, you don't find a lot of west facing windows.
Yes.
because you'll absolutely bake.
Yeah. And I know that sometimes when I go on holidays, and I'm sure other people, you see these apartment buildings with very small windows and these kind of shutters coming down, and you're like, oh, if only we had the hot weather in Ireland, we'd open it up and we'd have these massive windows. And of course, when you're living in those temperatures, and we have not forgotten that there's lots and lots of really tragic circumstances in France in particular at the moment due to the heat. Aircon units are the other thing that are very, very commonplace in hot countries. Are you seeing clients now, the residential clients, incorporating them into houses now, or is it still a bit here notions?
Occasionally. And of course, there's a cost, both installation cost and a running cost to these, you know. And to be fair, if, you know, as you're looking at either an extension or a new built house, there are ways that you can avoid the need for these, even with raising temperatures. The, you know, the best advice you can give to somebody with, you know, my house is too hot, is open a window. Now, that seems pretty facetious, but, you know, and if that doesn't work, open two. It's kind of
top architectural advice there from Michal Dishoon.
But it hides a different idea. If you're lucky enough to live in a house or an apartment that has dual aspect, that is to say, external walls that face in different directions, you can generate an airflow through your house. That is to say, open a window on one side, open a window on another side. And even on the vanishingly rare days where we don't have wind, you're still going to get different air pressures on either side of your house. And so that will create a breeze through the home. And where that breeze is coming from matters as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you're going with designing and thinking about houses in this way, about the designs of the houses, you can look at, okay, so what's outside the window, right? So a pretty good device for shading in summer and yet letting light through in the winter is a tree, because, you know, the leaves come off in winter and they let an awful lot more light through. And then in the summer, you know, they've got a lot of leaves. Now, obviously, I'm talking about deciduous trees, but and it still has the same effect, even with air that might move through your home. So, for example, if you've opened your kitchen window at the front and your dining room window at the back, and you're getting an airflow through, obviously all your doors need to be open as well. But it's okay. This only happens 2 weeks in a year. But you will get that. And if you're drawing, let's say that air is coming across a driveway, and now we start to talk about the urban heat island effect. Now, there's a lot of research has gone into that in recent years, but what it really describes is something that's very easy to intuit. If you stand beside a tarmac-adamed road or a big car park, you're going to feel that heat bouncing up off it. And, you know, that does happen, roofs, etc., all the way around the cities. But if you stand in front of a lawn, a planted area, stand under a shady tree, you'll get that much cooler effect, because what's happening is that the plants are pulling the water out of the ground and evaporating it up into the atmosphere. And if you draw an airflow across that in through your home, it's going to be an awful lot more pleasant.
So when we're planning and deciding builds, and I know now that developers and architects are, not only do the regulations say you have to do this and you have to have these green space and you have to have dual aspect and all this kind of thing, but actually it makes complete common sense when that's done. And we know from older blocks that we've seen where they have fully tarmacked the front and let people, you know, no gardens, maybe tiny little concrete balconies. Like, you're definitely going to feel the difference there between what we're building nowadays and what we used to build, say, in the 60s and 70s when that first social housing cohort came on stream.
Yeah. And you know, what we expect from our houses evolves, you know. Whatever, about 150, 200 years ago, you know, you wouldn't have expected a beautiful view. You would have been living in a stone cottage, you know, that was in its own way responding to the environment, low pitched roofs, that kind of thing, thick stone walls, very small windows, because, you know, most of the time you're losing heat out through those holes. Whereas we've come now to expect our buildings to be reasonably warm in winter, even if they're not aerated, you know, heatable, and not completely bake us in the summer. So you're right. And the dual aspect, for example, the ability to open a window in two different walls, makes a huge difference.
Now, we have seen practically every second house now is, and all new houses have solar panels. And maybe we are, you know, I know there was a bit of a laugh when the solar panel thing started in Ireland. There was a bit of like, are you joking? It's a bit like the windmill. Like, we don't get any sun. But of course, they only need light.
Correct.
And they are on all houses. Has that movement, that policy, been a success in your view, or is there more we could be doing there?
It certainly has driven people's awareness of the need to use renewables. Regulations drive that as well, particularly in new builds. And the technology has come to meet it, you know, as the market...
And the grants.
And the grants, you know, absolutely,
yeah,
you know. And, you know, even 10 years ago, you didn't get the efficiencies from PV photovoltaic panels that you do now. And it doesn't feel that long ago that, you know, we were using evacuated tube solar panels where they were really only heating water. And you didn't get a great lot of benefit from that. But the PV panels, and I suppose as our relationship to energy has become a lot sharper, the you know, electric cars, heat pumps that do heat A-rated homes do run on electricity. But there was always the problem of... you get it when you don't need it. And that's always been the trickiest part with renewables, is that you get a lot of energy when you maybe don't always need it.
Yeah, which is bang in the middle of summer when you don't have the heating on, and you might be using the bit of water and electricity. Yeah. So it's about that balance. But there are more and more homes now who are able to get back to the grid. You know, there's a kind of a small financial incentive to do that.
Absolutely. And look, micro generation, we do think is going to play a part and is playing a small part in meeting energy needs.
Yeah. Good. All right. Well, it sounds positive, and it sounds as if even if we do experience more of these temperatures, and I know most listeners out there, and I'm one of them, is saying, great, bring it on. But there are downsides to it, and we do need to be conscious of that. All right, Micheál Shún, thank you for that. Very interesting conversation on all of that. And Micheál is Director of Dishoon Architecture. Good news emerged from the Department of Finance that mortgage arrears have fallen to a 16-year low. 22,000 residential home loans are now behind payments for over 90 days, that's 3 months. But the figure jumps to 36,000, or 17% of all mortgages, when you include all arrears. Well, here to explain a little bit more about these figures and what they mean is Mitchell O'Brien, who is the founder of IRS Ireland and a PIP, which is a personal insolvency practitioner. And one of the original ones, Mitchell. Welcome to the Home Show.
Thank you very much for having me, Sinead.
Now, this is good news, right? I mean, it's good that arrears are down to an all-time low, but the 16,000, the numbers that they are, 22,000, I mean, that's still high by European standards, isn't it?
It is. It's 5% or 1 in 20. I think when I read these figures and dug into them, the first thing that occurred to me, look, a lot done, but more to do.
Right. Okay. It's an old election slogan.
it seems to be appropriate here. It is good that arrears numbers are coming down, but when you dive into the data that the central bank publishes on its website, they break it down into people up to 90 days in arrears, between 3 months and six months, between 6 months and a year and 2 years, 2 and 5 years, 5 and 10 years, and over 10 years.
Wow. So, I mean, the fact that people are 5 or 10 years in arrears, like that they literally haven't made a payment on their mortgage, they're living kind of rent and mortgage free. Why haven't their houses been repossessed at this stage? Like the MARP process that is there to help people who are in arrears and get them through a hump, if you like that's not really supposed to apply for people kind of who are chronically behind for nearly a decade.
It isn't the case at all that these people in arrears haven't made payments. The central bank have a tab on their data. It's actually table 5, titled Borrower Engagement. Now, there are 8,540 of those in a restructure, but are still deemed in arrears. There are 16,666 people. That's 1 in 4 sixes. Not on a restructure arrangement, but who are engaging and making payments.
Okay, so they're under a kind of a permanent modification, and they have come to an arrangement with the lender to allow them to live in the house and make maybe payments on what they can afford under the central bank rules. Are banks doing enough to get these figures under control, or are they these arrear levels okay, and they can kind of keep them on their balance sheet?
Well, firstly, of the 18,999, so we'll call that 19,000 families that are over a year in arrears, every single one of them are with a non-bank lender.
Mm. Okay, so these are not the mainstream lenders like AIB and Bank of Ireland and PTSB. These are loans that have been bundled and moved on to be kind of with somebody who isn't a mainstream bank in Ireland.
Correct. Now, I've done some calculations, and the reductions are in the region of about 17%. However, that cohort of borrowers who are in arrears over 10 years have only been reduced by 4%. only 174 of over 4,000 family homes in mortgage arrears have been resolved in the last year.
Right. So that sounds like a very stubborn figure then. Is there, what could be done there, or is there anything to do?
Well, if you consider, if they are over 10 years in arrears, the likelihood is that they're still legacy cases from the 2008 to 2012 banking and property crash. If those people were in their 50s 15 years ago, you know, they're much older now and they have less income. They're age challenged and income challenged, I think is the polite way of saying they're older and they're poorer.
They're pensioners.
So they are pensioners and they don't have the resource to be able to pay a restructured mortgage. As you know, there are three components to coming up with any mortgage payment. That's the amount owed, the interest rate applicable, and the term over which somebody is going to pay. If you're older, you have less years left in your life to be able to repay. So we're going to have to come up with a creative solution for this cohort of people, because there is, we can't see them thrown out of their homes, because if they are, they have no place to go.
Of course. And is it just, I mean, is turning a blind eye a pathway?
Well, I think that's the pathway that has led us to where we are. You know, the only thing in life that I can guarantee you, Sinead, is this day next year, you and I will either be a day older or a year older or dead. You know, and these people, the mental anguish associated with dealing with mortgage arrears, getting the letters every month, getting the phone calls, is just too much for this cohort. That any reasonable person knows that they're not going to be able to resolve these mortgage arrears short of handing back the keys of the house. And if they hand back the keys of the house, they have no place to go.
Yeah, and the state, which kind of stood over this crisis, as it were, would then have to be in a rehousing position. The cost of living crisis, Mitchell, I mean, look, everybody's finding it tough, especially since Russia invaded Ukraine. So we're looking at 4 or more years of prices being very, very high for fuel, for groceries, for transport, for all kinds of things. Is that impacting on the number of people who, new people who may go into arrears? Are you getting calls from people who are struggling with their mortgage at the moment?
Yeah, there are two types of insolvencies out there at the moment. And an insolvency is somebody who doesn't have enough income to meet their financial commitments as they fall due, right? So if you can't afford to pay your electricity bill or pay your mortgage, whether you like it or not, you're insolvent. So the only question then is, are you going to reach out for assistance under the insolvency legislation? But here's a startling one. At a time that the country is thought to be booming, 13,399 new mortgage arrears cases in the last quarter.
Oh gosh, that's a very high figure now, isn't it?
13,399 families were unable to pay their mortgage in full in the last 90 days.
Right. So that is a problem that is continuing. So there's a backlog. There's a legacy lot of people, as we know, as you've said, from maybe 15 years ago, 10 years ago. But there's now new cohort of people adding to those numbers. So that's going to be a problem. That's going to be a problem for the government. It's going to be a problem for banks. Where should people turn? Where should they go if they feel that they are in financial difficulty with their mortgage, Mitchell?
Well, those people, and another point that's been published recently is that there's over 500,000 families that are in arrears on their electricity and gas bills.
Yeah, indeed.
Now, in our experience, people will keep the lights on before anything else. So the question that I have is, if somebody can't afford to pay their electricity bill, what else can't they afford to do?
Indeed.
Immediately, they should reach out. If it's a budget, a short-term budgeting issue, they should reach out to MABS.
MABS.ie, fantastic, MABS. The state budgeting service.
Yeah. if it's a mortgage arrears problem, I believe they should reach out to us as IRS Ireland. We're probably the largest PIP practice in the country now. We have offices in Dublin and Dungarvan, or any other personal insolvency practitioner. And the list of the contact details of PIPs nationwide will be available on backontrack.ie. But people can come directly to us on irs-ireland.com.
All right. Mitchell O'Brien, thank you. And actually, the ISI, the Insolvency Service, that backontrack.ie is a fantastic website, fantastic resource, great videos, talk through the process and all of that. I can't recommend it highly enough. Mitchell O'Brien, thank you for joining us on The Home Show today. And coming up after the break, well, Denise O'Connor will be in from Optimise to tell us why we shouldn't be stressing out over our renovation. See you in a few moments.
The Home Show on News Talk. The Home Show on News Talk.
Welcome back to The Home Show here on News Talk. Sinead Ryan with you till the top of the hour. Hope you have enjoyed our guests so far. If you've missed any of the show, and especially our series on manor houses and old country homes being converted into exclusive wedding venues and the backstory behind some of those, they're fascinating. They will all be up on podcast, which is also called The Home Show, and you'll find that on Go Loud or wherever you get your pods. Now, social media like Instagram and AI models can be a huge help when it comes to planning a home renovation project, but they can be pretty and perfect and idealistic, aspirational, but not very realistic a lot of times. But my next guest and Home Show regular, Denise O'Connor of Optimised Design, says that sometimes we can lose the good in search of the perfect. Denise, welcome to The Home Show. What's Thanks. Wrong with perfect? That's a Pinterest and Instagram. It's gorgeous.
It
Budget,
is.
No expense spared.
No, no, no. I think it's just a lot of pressure, you know, to be putting on yourself. And especially for something like a home renovation where you've got so many moving parts, there's so many different people involved. Very, very difficult to have everything, absolutely everything perfect.
As an interior designer, do you have clients coming to you saying, I saw this on such and such a website, this is what I want in my home?
Oh yeah, regularly. So that's normally what people would come with, is a collection, be it enormous or more curated, of inspiration images. And that is what they want. That is what they would like to achieve.
But rather than being like a thought storyboard, it's more like, this is exactly
this
what
is
I want.
This is exactly what I want. Okay. Exactly.
It's a bit yeah. like going to the hairdressers and saying, yeah. I want this. It's celebrity's haircut, yeah. and they're going, yeah, your yeah. hair's not going to do that. Good luck with that.
Yes, yeah.
Do you have to let people down gently?
Yeah, it can be really, really hard, because I think some people find it difficult to imagine a transformation in their own space. So it's hard for people to understand. People find it hard to read drawings. So that's why, like, we would try and draw everything in 3D to really try and create as realistic a version of what they're going to get as possible. Because your home mightn't have the same aspect, the same space, the same ceiling heights. So all of those things are going to be a massive factor in how the end result is going to look.
Mm. I'm one of those people that missed out on the spatial skills gene. I have no capacity. Do you remember those old maths problems you used to get in school? Yeah. And they'd have a flash design and say, what will this look like when it's all in 3D?
Yeah,
no
yeah.
idea. It could be a boat. It could be a bus. It could be a dog.
Brilliant.
No idea.
Yeah.
So that is a drawback, though, because when you're looking at architectural plans or drawings, they are tend to be flat, and you've got the little swingy things for
hard.
The doors
yeah,
and the little.
Yeah.
I can't visualize that. So AI and tools can help with that.
They can be really helpful, but like with text or any kind of writing, they can make mistakes. So they can alter scale. They can, if you're, say, putting in a photo of your living room and your perfect idea of how you want that to look from Pinterest or Instagram or wherever, it can take more of the inspiration image and put it into your space and widen your space or alter the height. So it won't be exactly what you're going to get at the end.
I did use ChatGPT, one of our other designers in our design chair slot, Paul Kinsler. had used ChatGPT to redesign his back garden, and we sent him off to look at all the other AI models, and he did a great report on it. Mm. I used it for my hall stairs landing.
Yeah.
And I asked it, you have to be very specific.
Very specific.
So I wanted the carpet taken up, I wanted a runner put down, I want the banisters changed, and I asked for a hall table to be put in. Now, there isn't the room for that in my hall.
Yeah.
Yet. It found it.
It found it.
It elongated my
That's right.
When I worked out, how did that fit there? They just made it up.
Yeah, yeah. And so that can be very hard for people who don't really understand the space and can't visualize how much space you have. So it can be a real challenge. You know, it's hard for them to see past that.
Okay. So this striving for perfection. Mm. People spend a lot of money on renovations.
Yeah.
They
want
it to look the way they want it to look. They might get their inspo from a hotel type style room or from, you know, an open plan kitchen they saw in their friend's house.
Yeah.
So, like, when you have to break the bad news to them, like, do people get stressed out by that? Or is it about working within what they can have?
Yeah, I think it's trying to get them to step back a little bit, because you can have very fixed ideas about what you think is the right way forward. Like, we would regularly meet people who want exactly what their neighbours have done.
Yeah.
My neighbours have done this, it works brilliantly. But actually when you
The neighbours may not want that.
No, exactly. But when you sit down with them, the neighbours have a different number of children, they don't have any pets, their long-term plan is completely different, their day-to-day lives are totally different. So actually, that solution is not going to work long-term for our clients. So it's very much about sort of talking through their vision into the future and then working backwards and saying, well, look, if we did this, that would mean this in the future for you. So we think this is a much better solution. Or the orientation of your house is completely different to your neighbor's house. You have a north facing garden, there's a south facing, therefore we think this is a better solution. So it's sort of trying to explain why we're arriving at the solution that we're arriving at.
Indeed, indeed. Yeah. Now, of course, renovations are very expensive. And they're a big job to do. Do you find sometimes that maybe it's better just to get on with what you can rather than waiting until all the kind of the boxes are ticked in your life?
Oh, absolutely. Like, it's, you know, it's really heartbreaking when you meet people who for years were putting off fixing things around the house or making changes around the house, like kitchen cupboards, you know, doors hanging off, all of this sort of stuff, putting up with stuff for maybe 10, 15 longer years. And then suddenly, because they were going to plan the big job, they were doing the big job. Mm. So there's no point investing until they did that. But then the kids moved out and suddenly you find there's two people in a house that's way too big for them. There's no need to do the big job.
Yeah.
But they've been miserable living with all these problems.
So what would you say, kind of, you know, they might say, well, I don't have the 50,000 it's going to take to redo this right now.
Mm.
And life is expensive and we have all the kids at home. Would you say do a little bit now and park the rest later? Or what do you recommend?
Yeah, again, everybody's situation is different. So if it's something that really isn't functioning, it's impacting your day to day, it needs to be fixed. Like, you have to maintain that. So yeah, there's a certain amount of upkeep you're going to have to keep doing. So I think it's foolish to sort of put off maintenance tasks because eventually you're planning a big job. If the big job, you genuinely have an end date and you know, look, we just need to save a little bit more to achieve what we need to do. We can see that we can do that in 5 years. That makes total sense, because there's no point starting a job when you don't have sufficient funds to do it. But maybe, you know, if you're sort of indefinitely putting it off because you feel the kids aren't the right age or there's no definite reason for doing it.
Or you're just perceiving all the hassle instead of the end result.
Yeah.
So, you can do most jobs now, most renovation in stage processes, like something this year, something in 2 years' time, you know, that maybe just finding out from somebody like you what won't impact on the rest. I don't have to put up a wall and then take down the wall to do something.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So to do that properly, you need to look at the big picture and then figure out a way with somebody to work it back and chunk it up into smaller projects.
Okay. And that's a good idea. Now, do you find then people have the... some of your clients have the opposite problem where they're like, I have the whole family coming at Christmas, so I want the new kitchen in.
Yeah, so that's kind of our worst nightmare, to be quite honest with you. So these hard emotional deadlines, I'd call them, like Christmas is a brilliant example. So we try and, you know, discourage a Christmas deadline.
Because you know the way builders work.
Absolutely. And that time of year, people are busy, people slow down, businesses close, you know. So it is just setting yourself up for a big headache and a lot of upset. So really trying to keep these sort of deadlines, away from family milestones like weddings or communions or whatever it might be, is a much safer bet.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's always going to take longer, isn't it?
It definitely will.
And
it just
more.
Means you have a bit of time contingency there. I think that's really important. People know about the budget contingency, but I think having a little buffer or a bigger buffer for time is equally important.
And I suppose there's the added thing, and this is just human nature. If perfection is your benchmark and you have a vision in your head about this gorgeous property, you know, this kind of Nancy Myers interior that you're going to end up with because you don't live in Maine, New England.
Yes.
There's an inevitable disappointment then,
of
maybe,
that
it's not what you planned.
Yeah.
Do you find, you know, talking people down off the ledge before they start is probably the best idea. But what do you do with that disappointment if you say, well, I love it, but there's something missing or wasn't how I thought it would look, even though everything's been done right?
Everything's been done right. I think that usually happens where people are expecting that almost, I'm going to say, show house look to their home when they walk in, that the ornaments are perfectly placed. And, you know, but that's not real life. I mean, if people have children, things are going to get spilt. Stuff is going to get knocked over. Things are going to get tossed about. The house has to look good when those things happen too. So it is allowing a little bit of life to happen in the house is really important.
I remember when I was looking at houses before I bought my current house and looking at different houses that, you know, I wanted a sense of it. And one of the houses in the estate where I eventually bought was one of these staged, styled. It was gorgeous. Everything was cushions, you know, karate chopped in half. All the colours matched. It was absolutely stunning. But I was walking around the house thinking, upstairs, thinking, this something isn't twigging with me.
Yeah.
And I realised not one of the bedrooms had wardrobe.
Oh my God.
And you're like, by the time you put that in,
it's so true.
And a dressing table, like that's half the room is
absolutely
gone because they were small rooms.
Indeed. Yeah.
And it looked perfect. And that just went over my head until after I'd left. So it's a funny thing, isn't it? You can see it in a magazine or on a website and think that's perfect. But when you are in it, you're like, where am I going to put everything?
But you know, you've hit the nail on the head. Those practicalities that seem like the boring bits, they're not the fun bits, they're not the bits that you're looking in for hours on Instagram at. They're the most important. And if you invest in those, all the dressing and accessories and styling can happen at any time. You know, that's nearly the easy bit, to be quite honest.
Yeah.
So getting the practicalities right, like somewhere to put your clothes, somewhere to dry the laundry, that really matters.
All right.
That's really important.
Well, look, like everything in life, you know, work, home life, parenting, good enough. Is good enough.
Absolutely.
Isn't that a life lesson for us all? All right. Denise O'Connor from Optimized Design there, and you can find her on Instagram and all of her masterclasses, I think we're going to call them. Pieces to camera on everything from paint colours to how to design bits of your home. And that's it. That's all we've time for on this episode. Hope you enjoyed all those elements. If there's anything you'd like us to feature on the show, any guests you'd like us to have on, or a topic to do with housing or architecture that you'd like us to cover, get in touch with us, thehomeshow@newstalk.com. You'll find me on Instagram, SineadRyan100. And of course, you can check back to all of our shows, especially if you're a new listener and you've enjoyed us in this slot. We used to be on early in the morning. So all those pods are up on the Go Loud app or Spotify or wherever you get your pods. My thanks to producer Aoife Breen. Ben Sweeney was on research and Stephen McClune on sound. We'll be back here next week with another episode. Like and subscribe now.
The Home Show with Sinead Ryan. Saturday at 5 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.